Hello there, and welcome to our podcast, Conversations in Noosa. My name is John Caruso. Michelle Lipner from Oz Harvest hails from California. She graduated with a master's degree in clinical psychology and a PhD in sociology. How did she end up in war-torn places like Ethiopia, Afghanistan, and Kosovo? On one occasion during a phone call to her mother, Michelle said, "It doesn't matter whether I live or die, because for the first time ever, I feel like I'm living my life." Imagine that. Because of Michelle's impressive resume, I asked her what she tells people when they meet her for the first time and ask her about herself. I hope you enjoy listening to this podcast.
Actually, I usually tell them very little because I don't ever know quite where to start. And usually I found that people just want the short answer rather than the long answer. So I say very little.
Why would people only want this? Do they get bored with the details?
I suspect so. I think that we're all living our own lives and we're all very busy. So when people ask, I usually just say little. And then I deflect to them and they ask them how they are and what they do.
Yeah, that is a good tactic. I've learned that too from radio. But all right, so let's examine your life a little bit more. You grew up in California.
Yes.
A master's degree in psychology and sociology.
Master's in psychology, and then decided to make sort of a break and to start afresh. And so decided to go and get my PhD in sociology.
Right. Whereabouts in California did you grow up?
Well, actually, that even in itself is a story because my father worked for an engineering company called Kaiser. And so as a child, we actually traveled quite a bit. And so I spent my formative years, I guess, when I was quite young in India. And then we came back to the States after his assignment was over. So I would say I predominantly grew up in California.
What was your, when you were at high school, when you were studying at school, did you have a thought in terms of this is what I'd like to do? This is the path, a career path that I'd like to chase or travel?
I wish I did say I had a career path, but my career paths tended to follow the latest movie I'd seen or a book I had read. So when I was a little kid, I remember to this day seeing Invasion from Mars, and it was all of these Martians coming, and this little boy sees the spaceship coming down, and I thought to myself, I'm going to be an astronomer. And then when I was in my high school years, I thought, oh, I read this great book, this author called Mary Stewart, and she wrote these romance novels for young girls, and I decided I was going to be a nanny in France because of one of the books, and I was going to meet somebody called Raoul and marry him. And so it was sort of a bumpy road until I actually, believe it or not, originally settled on psychology.
Yeah.
And so that then became my career path when I started with university. But then what happened is that I finished university and then I was deciding I was going to go overseas and become a Peace Corps volunteer. And instead, my father got very ill and died, actually. So I was 21 when he died. And that kind of derailed me and my plans for, I'd say, the next 15 years.
Wow.
Of trying to determine what I wanted to do and be when I grew up.
Yeah.
And although I did study psychology and got a master's in psychology, I actually found that my personality was a little too big for that. That while I was good, I thought I was a good therapist. I thought that I wanted to transfer kind of that energy into something that was more outward, which is then how I settled on sociology and moved to Missouri, the University of Missouri in Columbia, to get my PhD in sociology.
Yeah, we all deal with death and the passing of a parent in different ways. But you said that it kind of rattled your world for about 15 years when your dad passed away.
Yes.
You must have been close. You were close to your dad?
I think I was very close to my dad, even if some of it was sort of just this sense of, although nobody is perfect, growing up, I had this image that he was sort of that perfect person. And I wanted to follow in his footsteps and make him proud of me. And so for a while, I thought maybe law. And then I thought maybe history. And so I just sort of fumbled around because I didn't have any sense of passion or commitment to anything. And I think that was the real issue for me, that nothing grabbed me in a way that made me feel passionate that I wanted to commit my professional life to.
Tell me about your journey then and the thought process behind being at the University of Missouri and then ending up part of the Peace Corps again through Afghanistan and those Middle Eastern countries. How did that come about?
Well, that was interesting in itself. It's like I always have a story. When I give presentations about myself and my work, what I always say is that I'm a pretty ordinary person that has just had extraordinary opportunity and sometimes extraordinary experience, good and bad, that's sort of taken me to a path. And I think that for what was happening, I was finishing up my PhD in sociology, and I thought, well, I don't want to teach. What do I want to do? And then I had a moment of serendipity when I received a phone call from somebody I had been working with in California, saying to me I had worked for this livestock research center as an administrative assistant when I was going through university and my master's degree in California. And so I had kept in touch with these people, and this person happened to be the head of a livestock research center in Ethiopia. And called me out of the blue to say, would you like to come to Ethiopia and help do some sociological papers for us since you're finishing up your PhD in sociology? And it was, interestingly, though, at a time when it was essentially at a time when a 17-year Marxist regime was coming to an end. And there was a lot of fighting going around and in Addis Ababa, the capital, and in the villages. And I said, wow, this sounds really exciting. And he said, well, how do you feel about gunfire? And I said, well, having never heard it before, I guess okay. So I thought, what a great adventure. And I'd say that probably set me on my course for my present.
Yeah.
And what I did is that I went. And then, of course, 2 weeks after I arrived in Addis Ababa, the 17-year Marxist regime was literally overthrown by rebels coming into Addis Ababa. And I was there listening to the tanks rolling by the streets into Addis. And I did call my mother in the middle of all this. And she said, where are you? And I said, I'm in Addis. And she said, why didn't you evacuate to Kenya? And I said, well, and I probably said the most stupid thing that a child can say to a parent, but it sounded really good at the time. And that is when I realized my course was set. And I said to her, and I think I can remember this quote totally. I said, well, actually, it doesn't matter if I live or die, because for the first time in my life, I feel like I'm actually living my life. And and every time I say that, I actually choke up because I realize that it was at that moment that I had found my passion and I had found my direction. And so
I know you'd seen some of the world already because, as you mentioned, with your dad's work, you'd had travel to India. So leaving your native country wouldn't have been completely strange to you. But at odds with what a lot of other people would say, if someone said, how do you feel about gunfire? And I don't know how young you were or how old you were at that point. A lot of them would say, oh, hang on a minute. And they would have second thoughts about traveling somewhere that was in such a state in terms of, you know, there's war, there's conflict. Where did you get that courage from?
Well, I was 35 years old, so I actually had gone back to get my PhD later in life. I was an older graduate student. I don't know where I got it. It's funny because as experience would show later on in my career, I found myself quite fearless when it came to going into conflict zones or post-conflict zones to work. I found it far more frightening for me, actually, to be caught up in a natural disaster that I felt like I had no control over. And I don't know how people have asked me that. I could be very courageous going into a third world country, into the Afghanistans or the Kosovos, but I was tentative to, let's say, go on holiday by myself, nervous about that, or to take a car and drive in a big city with a lot of traffic.
You're more nervous about that
driving
kind of
into big
environment.
City, correct. Than I might be than being in an environment that where theoretically my life might be at risk.
Yeah. But both of those things are out of your control. I did read that quote from you because you did some work at the time following the Boxing Day tsunami, I think. And that's when I read that quote from you. You said you would rather be in a war zone where you felt, more control?
More in control.
More in control in terms of your life and your destiny. And so many stories, Michelle. I mean, where do we start? If you had to pick a point or a moment when you were serving in any one of these places that really struck you, that really made you think about the kind of work that you're doing, that gave you more strength in terms of the work that you're doing?
There are so many, actually. But I do have to say that the one that really humbled me and made me realize how not only how special the work I was, how special the work was that I was doing, but how much we as individuals can make an impact, and we don't realize how much of an impact that is, was probably when I first started out doing actually international aid and development, because I just talked about Ethiopia. That was more being a sociologist and doing kind of that more the writing and the research. But it was my first posting overseas in international aid and development, which is in the Republic of Georgia after the breakup of the former Soviet Union. And I have talked about this before, but I think it was I was deployed to be the head of a country program for a non-governmental organization in the U.S. that had received a couple of million dollars to help rebuild the health sector in the Republic of Georgia, and to provide health support to people who had been directly affected by the conflict. And there was one woman that came in to my office, and she had just gotten out of the hospital. She had just been diagnosed with breast cancer, and she had said that she had come from a breakaway republic called Abkhazia, and because she was from this republic, breakaway republic, she was not treated very well. But the doctors had told her that in order for her to have follow-up surgery, she needed to have a whole regimen of medicines, and she had no money, and could we help? And as she's telling me this story, she lifts up her shift that she's wearing, and she just shows me her breast with the bandages all around. And I was pretty struck by this story, needless to say, and it was very confronting to me. And I just looked at her and I said, whatever we have to do, we will take care of you. And we will find you the medicines. And we will ensure that you will have them within the end of the day. And she then got down on her feet, on her knees, and started to kiss my feet. And I almost burst into tears because I just was so overwhelmed by that. And I told her to stand up and never, never kneel for anybody, that what she was asking me was her right as a human being and not a privilege. And she should never, ever have to respond that way again. And I remembered walking away thinking how, again, one person's act of kindness can have such an impact on somebody else's life. And that what I was doing was extremely serious, and to treat it with the utmost respect. And I never forgot either of those points. And I think that was actually what set me on that really probably made a difference in everything I did henceforth.
Do you talk to people about that? I mean, that giving, about the way that it makes, I mean, you know, what you're describing are environments that a lot of us wouldn't be familiar with. But what that was an incredible story, that sense of giving and helping others.
Sometimes I do.
Because that's remarkable. The world needs, doesn't it?
I think the world needs far more of it. I know that when I have given talks in the past, I don't necessarily raise that story. Sometimes I do, but what I do is also raise it in terms of where my passion is that whole notion that, to me, there are certain basic rights for every human being, and that's the right for shelter, for health, for education, for food, et cetera, yeah. And that I am outraged that there are so many countries, including my own homeland, that see those basic rights as privileges rather than as basic human rights. And so that's how I tend to really talk about that. And I think that that's what I tried to do in the work I did as well, was to promote that notion that these are basic rights,
yeah,
and that we have individually and collectively a responsibility to try to address that.
I'm also talking about that sense of fulfillment, though, when you act in that way.
Yes.
And, you know, that is something that we could all, you know, do more of.
To me, and I've said this to other people, that if you don't have a sense of passion about what you do, if you don't have a sense of commitment, and if you're not having fun, it's time to move on and do something else. I feel extremely blessed that in my life, I, out of just circumstance and happenstance and serendipity happened to be in the right time in the right place to set me on a course where I was actually able to live a work life of passion and commitment. And I don't know how many of us can say that.
The life that you're living now, well, it is on the other side of the world. Was he an Australian, your husband? Because he made a promise to you. He said, you met him, where did you meet him?
In Afghanistan.
And he said that he wanted to take you away, and you wanted to, you know, he's going to get you to live by the water.
Well,
is
when,
that right?
Well, look, when I was in Afghanistan, I was working for the UN mission, United Nations Assistance Mission in Afghanistan, and I was the head of the regional office for the northern part of the country. And at the time, there was still conflict going on in the southern part of the country, but the north was, I put in quotes, relatively quiet. But there was a lot of conflict with local warlords. So what was going on in Afghanistan was that there was a whole contingent of military advisors that were seconded by their different governments. And Australia had seconded to the UN mission as part of their military advisory support, a lieutenant colonel in the Australian Army to serve in that role. And so he was deployed actually to my neck of the woods to be my military advisor. And as he likes to say, he gave me more advice than the military. I mean, it's a really good example of good civil-military cooperation.
Yeah.
And so I fell in love with this man. He was deployed up there, and he was there for a year. Well, I was there for 2 years. He was there the second year. And he said that he would take me away and to live by the water, and that he loved me, and So I said, of course, yes, I'll come with you. And I come to Australia, and we live in Canberra next to Lake Burley Griffin. And so that was, and I remembered, so in 2010, after living in Canberra from 2004 to 2009-10, I essentially said to him,
it was by the water.
Where's the water? Lake Burley Griffin is lovely, but that doesn't cut it. So we then.
Parisian.
Yes, we came up here where there was water.
Yeah.
And
waves,
a lot of it.
Yeah.
So
and that's a better climate.
Better climate, yes.
When you've been involved in the kind of work that you've done, Michelle, for so long, how do you reflect and kind of reconcile? I imagine you're walking along the beach, you know, the waves and sunset, whatever, or, you know, sunrise early in the morning, and then think about the life that you've lived in all of lived in all of these places that you just mentioned.
In some respects, I'm being totally honest, I think, with this answer. In some respects, I never have felt as though I have ever really belonged where I am, that I am sort of a traveler.
Restless. Yeah.
Yes, and I think that I will always be that person. And that's, I think, what partly got me into aid work originally, and that moving. I have lived in Australia as an adult longer than I've lived anywhere before as an adult.
Yeah.
And I just have this sense of wanderlust. But I think when I reflect, I mean,
Do you feel a pull, like you want to go back and still continue and do more of that?
I actually have always felt that,
yeah,
that there's that pull to go back. But I think that's why I then transferred a lot of that energy and passion into setting up Oz Harvest. It was my way of somehow containing all of that energy and redirecting it locally rather than internationally. I am still very acutely aware of what's going on in the world, and I still feel this sense of passion. And I mean, even when I read about and heard about the Ethiopian Airlines crash, the first thing I thought of was, I wonder if I knew anybody, partly because that's such a normal route for anybody that works in that part of the world, and having worked there. And I'm still very much tuned in with friends who are very much involved in that world. And so there's always the draw, and I will always miss it. But I also feel like that my relevancy has moved on to something else.
Sure.
And that currently is,
yeah,
more in terms of Oz Harvest.
All right, you've done that. Well, let you tell me about your involvement and the passion that you're putting into Oz Harvest now.
Well, Oz Harvest is essentially a food rescue program. What it does is that it's all about helping feed people in need, and at the same time trying to reduce the amount of food going to landfill. So it's a food rescue program, but it also tries to raise awareness on the whole environmental side of the impact of food waste on the environment and how to reduce that. So it was established in 2004 by a woman named Ronnie Kahn. I'm sure many have heard her, seen her in action, a very dynamic lady. And I had heard about OzHarvest when I was actually living in Canberra. And when I moved to the Sunshine Coast in 2010, I was still working remotely and doing consulting, but I was thinking about the future and how to channel that and my energy into something local, and then thought that OzHarvest sounded like something that would be a really great thing to do in the coast. So to cut a long story short, I essentially set up this program in 2014 with two or three volunteers and a few food donors in the area and a few charities, and launched in 2014. And I can talk more about the stats later, but I think that it's what the whole thing about it, and I think where my passion really lies was the whole around the whole two themes that OzHarvest tries to really combat, or the issues. Like when you think, for example, that we produce enough food to feed 60 million people in this country, but over 4 million people every year still go hungry, those statistics are appalling. And then when you realize as well that, you know, we have 650,000 people a month that rely on food aid, that in the Sunshine...
How many, sorry, say that again?
650,000 people a
domestically.
Month. Domestically relying on food aid.
Wow.
In this country a month. It's a ridiculous reality that we waste so much food in this country alone, and yet there's such need. So OzHarvest actually marries those two concepts. And in the Sunshine Coast, our program is fully volunteer-based, and we collect up to maybe 2,000 kilos of food a week from various sources, national partners, local partners, and we distribute to over about 40 agencies up and down the coast, all the way from Gympie down to Caloundra and into the hinterland.
So is the organization just a Southeast Queensland, no, it's a national?
It's a national program.
Right.
There are offices in all the major capitals. So the national program is based in, the headquarters is based in Sydney. And as I said, there are programs throughout the country. And then there are regional programs like mine that have been generated and started by the enthusiasm of the individuals who say, hey, I think this is a good idea.
Yeah.
Can I start a program here? And that's how I actually started OzHarvest on the coast. I contacted OzHarvest and said, I think this is a great concept. How do I get involved? And since there was no presence here, I said, can I start one? And they said, yes. So I think the rest is essentially history. What I love about this is that I think that when you just think about the fact that we've rescued over 220,000 kilos of food in 4.5 years, and that food has gone to local people in need, which is in itself an amazing feat, but that we also are diligently trying to work around changing attitudes and behaviors on how we see food. And so getting that messaging out, I think I'm very passionate about as well, so that we can all become part of that whole movement towards zero waste.
Yeah.
So it's really both that social conscience, but also social impact.
How many volunteers do you have?
Now I have over almost 70.
Wow.
It's a lot.
And you would work every day, every week?
I would work every day.
In terms of collecting?
Uh-huh.
And how are our restaurants going in terms of that waste management?
Some restaurants are actually quite savvy on the waste management.
I imagine they would have to be. You're running a successful business. There's got to be, you've got to tighten the belt somewhere and be careful with the way you're preparing food.
Some are very, very careful, and some actually have some amazing ways in which they deal with their surplus. And others, though, I think have a way to go, as do major supermarkets at all. We don't actually collect much from the local restaurants. We far more collect from local producers, from national partner Woolies and BP. We'll collect from them. We go to farmers markets, bakeries, butchers. So it's interesting, though, how much waste we do produce. And if you just think at a local scale that I collect with my volunteers about 10,000 kilos of food a month, multiply that nationwide and just think about all that waste. And it's quality food. Yeah. And a lot of it's, and this is part of the educational side of it, a lot of that surplus, this is an interesting statistic, actually comes from the farm. Because of cosmetic value or the perceived cosmetics, that 20 to 40% of all food doesn't even make it off the farm.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
that to me is a travesty. Correct. Yeah, yeah. That's a travesty. I will be picking up eggs from a local producer close by who oftentimes donates to us because the eggs are too small or too big and can't sell them in market. And so if it weren't for Oz Harvest or other organizations like us, that stuff would be plowed right under. So it's pretty much a travesty. And I don't think people also realize that when stuff, if things get thrown away and they get into landfill, I mean, 20% of all landfill is food waste. And food produces methane gas. Think about the effect of all that methane gas on the environment. And as I like to tell people, landfill is not a compost bin. There's no oxygen that goes through, nothing moves, and this would probably shock you, but it takes 25 years for a head of lettuce to decompose in landfill. 25 years. So imagine all that food waste that goes there. So it's part of my passion is around trying to get that message out and trying to not only raise awareness, but say, what can we do as an individual, as a family, as a community, as a business to reduce food waste?
I imagine you're always looking for more people to put their hand up and be part of the organization.
Sure.
If I am part of a family that's on Struggle Street and I'm finding it hard to make ends meet, how do I get in touch with Oz Harvest? Via the website?
What we do is that we, through our volunteer base, we have regular pickups from our food suppliers 6 days a week. And then we distribute that food directly to schools, charities, community groups, churches, and other registered charities. So the food actually goes there. And I think it would surprise you to know as well how many schools we actually give fresh fruit and other foods to through their chaplaincy programs, because the statistics don't lie. 1 out of 5 kids go to bed at night or to school in the morning hungry. And so that is the sort that's really is an amazing statistic. And the fact that so many schools have so many kids who are struggling, or families of those children who are struggling, it's not a pretty picture.
Yeah.
But we support the recipients through the agencies.
Yeah. With the work that you've done and the work that you're doing now and this, you know, compassion and empathy and this willingness to want to help. Are you a spiritual or religious person, Michelle?
What a good question, which requires, I think, a really thoughtful response. I think I'm a spiritual person. I don't think of myself as a religious person, but spiritual, yes. I don't know how to answer that, though, really. Yeah.
It sounds like you always have itchy feet. Do you think that you'll continue to live in this part of the world for the foreseeable future, or is there a desire to travel more, revisit places you've already been to?
I actually, strangely enough, imagine myself probably staying here for the rest of my life. I have no desire or a plan to go back to my roots in the U.S. Even when I lived in the U.S. growing up, I didn't see myself living in the U.S. I am surprised that I have a sense of, how do I say this, rootedness in where I am. But I am very lucky that I have this wonderful husband who I came to Australia with, and a very loving husband, and that I love what I do with Oz Harvest. And I think that I'm pretty lucky, it really, in what I have. And there's no better place in the world that I can imagine living right now, except maybe the south of France. But my French just isn't good enough.
Do you have family still back in California?
I have sisters in California and New York.
Yeah.
Yes.
I don't want to get into political issues or whatever.
Thank you.
What's the feeling? What's the mood in the US? I'll tell you from an Australian's perspective. If you go back 20, 25 years ago, the US used to be a place of an aspirational destination, whether you were in entertainment or business. You know, there was a desire, you know, if you made it in, not the old Frank Sinatra song, but if you made it in the US, then you've made it.
Well, if you make it in New York, you well, can make it anywhere.
Simply because of the sheer size of the population, the size of North America. But these days, with everything that's going on, and maybe it's social media, I'm not sure, it doesn't appear to be that aspirational destination that it was to not just Australians, but a lot of other people. Am I correct there in thinking that? Is the mood the same for citizens and residents in the US?
I don't know if you can generalize. I could certainly say amongst most of my cohort, there's a sense of despair. And I don't think that there is a great sense of optimism in a place that people think that they want to flock to either visit or work or spend a significant amount of time in currently, but appreciate as well that my cohort is different from others. And on social media, my cohort is more of like mind. I think that certainly I have a lot of friends that would like to move here right now. So that would probably give you a better sense of, certainly for my group of people, that there is a great deal of angst. And I think that the whole notion of a gentle and kind America is, I don't feel that, I don't see that.
Is there hope that might change?
I fear that the U.S. has changed forever and not necessarily for the better.
Really? All right. Well, the south of France still sounds...
South of France sounds great.
Like a great destination. Michelle, I really appreciate you coming in and sharing some of your incredible story and spending some time with us today. Thank you.
No, thank you.
Remarkable story, isn't it? Michelle Lipner there from Oz Harvest. If you enjoyed that story, if you think someone else might get something out of it, they might connect, it might be relatable to someone else, please feel free to share the podcast about on your social media channels. If you're listening to us via Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Wooshka, Spotify, if there's an opportunity for you to rate and review the podcast, I'd really appreciate that. Until next time, take care.